Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ivan Haddad, professor at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding, who discusses the efforts to salvage the fragile Middle East peace process in the wake of violent clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators that have claimed more than 100 lives, mostly Palestinian. Nick Penniman, director of the Alliance for Democracy, who described his group's campaign of civil disobedience at the U.S. Capitol, which is demanding an overhaul of the nation's campaign finance system and public funding for all federal elections. And Mary Alice Waters, president of Pathfinder Press, who reflected on the history of the Cuban Revolution and continued U.S. aggression at a community forum recently held at Yale University titled Ending the Cold War with Cuba. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In cities across the United States, the federal government is providing funds for mock terrorist attacks. National security and military officials want to see what would happen if a terrorist cell set off a chemical or nuclear device in a city, and the response from the local police and other emergency services to such a crisis. The U.S. government now spends $11 billion a year on counterterrorism exercises, a 140% increase since 1996. But these tests are unrealistic, according to Mother Jones magazine. Few terrorists ever use weapons of mass destruction, because these devices are complex and difficult to use. And most incidents in the U.S., about 4 per year, according to FBI data, involve acts of arson and pipe and mail bombs. Reacting to the major bomb attacks at the World Trade Center and the government building in Oklahoma City, the Clinton administration gave vast powers to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to chase terrorists. In a move that still alarms civil liberties advocates, the 1996 Anti-Terrorism Act gave the FBI the ability to spy on people who gave money or other aid to groups suspected of promoting terrorism. In 1999, the State Department put 30 groups on the terrorist list, ranging from Basque separatists to Hamas and Hezbollah. Since 1996, the FBI's anti-terrorism budget has soared from $68 million to $609 million, and the number of FBI agents investigating terrorists has tripled. Now there are calls in Washington to put the Pentagon in charge of anti-terrorism efforts, an alarming situation for those concerned with the erosion of civil liberties. They fear that Army units could one day be authorized to make civilian arrests or engage in search and seizure operations targeting groups engaged in legal political activity. It's a truism that every action produces a reaction, and the push for corporate globalization is no exception. Such was the focus of a recent article in The Nation magazine, which examined some reactions to the policies of the global corporate elite. Public relations departments for the multinationals are scrambling to produce codes of conduct, each designed to show the public just how much they care about people. And while a cynic might point out the degree to which such documents are merely words, each standard provides social justice activists a tool to hold governments and corporations accountable. Other codes are starting to surface as well. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development recently rediscovered a document titled Guidelines for Multinational Enterprises, which first emerged during the 70s. Outrageous from the viewpoint of the business leaders, these guidelines dare to suggest that companies consult with labor in determining their policies. The United Nations has also joined the movement for increased corporate accountability, as poorer nations find globalization to be eerily reminiscent of the old colonialism. To this end, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has announced the creation of a UN webpage, unglobalcompact.org, to bring together human rights organizations, multinationals, and labor federations. And while the UN lacks any legal authority to affect global business, they hope that a forum of this type can help better represent the viewpoints of the poor and their advocates. It may well be that the United Nations is the only institution left on the global stage with the potential power to restrain the influence of corporations from running roughshod over the interests of the majority of people in the world. Medea Benjamin, the human rights activist turned Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate from California, is campaigning against President Clinton's plan to send $1.4 billion in new military aid to Colombia. According to the Progressive magazine, she expressed her opposition this summer by standing outside a San Francisco drug treatment clinic and blasting away at incumbent Senator Dianne Feinstein, a moderate Democrat. For Benjamin, a co-founder of Global Exchange and former economist with the World Health Organization, the solution to civil war in Colombia and waves of drug trafficking is more drug treatment at home, not sending U.S. military hardware and advisors to war-torn Colombia. Along with moderate Republican Tom Campbell, Benjamin is taking on Feinstein, who has close ties with wealthy developers, by debating the need for a livable wage, universal health care, cutting spending on prison expansion, banning genetically modified food, and the need for public financing of political campaigns. A longtime human rights activist, Benjamin, who helped mobilize thousands of protesters against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, only recently concluded that the time was right for the Green Party and to build coalitions between eco-activists and labor and minority communities. Benjamin has raised over $200,000 for her campaign and has mobilized a full-time field staff of organizers. Ironically, Benjamin is fighting for the loyalty of liberal voters with maverick Republican candidate Jim Campbell, who is pro-choice, opposes military intervention, and condemns the war on drugs. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Although an emergency peace summit convened by the U.S. and Egypt succeeded in reaching a ceasefire agreement, confidence was low that it would end weeks of escalating violence between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators. More than 100, mostly Palestinian youth, have died in bloody street battles in the West Bank, Gaza, and parts of Israel. The agreement signed in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, called for both sides to pull back from the brink of igniting a new Middle East war. Despite Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's position that the United Nations should lead an investigation into the causes of the recent violence, the ceasefire agreement signed in Egypt calls for the U.S. to direct that review. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ivan Haddad, professor at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. She discusses the efforts to salvage the fragile Middle East peace process and the role of the U.S. in future negotiations.
I think that people are fed up with the peace process, and specifically on the Palestinian side, because it has delivered nothing. And I think they're beginning to raise more serious questions, and that is whether the American team that is leading the peace process can be objective, whether it is, as the American team claims, that it is an honest broker. There is no way it can be an honest broker since it is headed by people that were plucked out of the Israeli lobby who are professionals promoting Israeli interests in the United States, including the person who is the ambassador of the United States to Israel. And he's a professional Israeli lobbyist, and how could they in any way be fair or just to the Palestinian people? And I think that this is the blindfold that the Clinton administration put itself in. It has 27 people that were taken out of the Israeli lobby and put in charge of the peace process. And obviously everything they schemed was in the interest of Israel. And they did not allow even one junior person who was an Arab American. They were against him and fired him from the State Department. And therefore, they never really listened to the other side and what the other side can live with. And therefore, there are grave questions about the credibility of the American administration.
If the U.S. can't be a fair and honest broker in future negotiations, who should be in that seat? Should that be the United Nations?
I think that the Palestinians would trust the United Nations, and of course the Israelis don't trust the United Nations because the United Nations is usually fair, whereas the American administration has come right out and said it supports Israel. I mean, Mrs. Albright came out with a statement, was it a couple days ago, in which she said that she felt that her role was to support the state and the security of, you know, the security of the state of Israel. It wasn't, in a sense, the security of the Palestinian people. And therefore, people in the Arab world are fed up. But they know that the United States is the only power in the world. It is using all its muscle to subjugate people to do its will. And the question is that if Mubarak and Abdullah of Jordan and Arafat acquiesce to Israeli interests, they would lose control of their people because all the Arab people are fed up.
I wonder if you would comment on the media coverage of the violence between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian demonstrators over the last several weeks. Has that coverage been fair in your view?
Absolutely not. The media has been one-sided, unfair, and racist. And all you have to do is look at the editorials of the Washington Post, the New York Times. I just saw something written by some president of the L.A. Times. And they are all pro-Israeli. The New York Times has put in a few op-ed pieces. The Washington Post, after protests from some Arab organizations, put in one op-ed piece from the Palestinian side. But right through, consistently, the press, the major press, has been very biased. If you looked at ABC, CBS, and NBC, at first they were very biased. Now they are beginning to put people from the other side. And, of course, NPR has consistently been biased, especially their reporter, Linda Gradstein, who reports from Israel. Her reports are always the Israeli side, and she uses euphemisms to cover up for anything. I mean, for example, Palestinians just die. They're never killed. But Israelis are always killed. And she has a lot of terms like that. There is one person who keeps tabs on all her reports from the area, and every day there is something that shows her bias.
Are you optimistic that the peace process can be revived and that a permanent and lasting peace can be negotiated in the next several months or years? What are the consequences if that doesn't happen, in your view?
To be honest with you, I personally am not optimistic. I'm not the only one depressed. There are a lot of people who sort of keep tabs on the situation, who are depressed because they believe that either the administration and the press have chosen not to understand or that they don't understand. And in either case, there is trouble coming along in the future because the Palestinian people cannot put up with this oppression anymore. And the thing that is interesting for, you know, from an Arab perspective is that when Iraq conquered Kuwait, the United States insisted in the United Nations that it should withdraw, and we used all our power to make them withdraw. Here is Israel that has been sitting on Palestinian homes in their land, kicking them out, and since 1967 has violated the United Nations, and the which asked it to withdraw, and the U.S. has done nothing. And the question that the Arabs keep asking is, why the hypocrisy? Why the double standard?
That was Ivan Haddad, professor at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. Contact the center by calling area code 202-687-2575 or visit their website at www.cmcu.net. A determined group of 16 activists, including medical students, physicians, and retirees, were arrested in the historic U.S. Capitol Rotunda on October 14th as they unfurled banners and called for an end to the nation's corrupt campaign finance system. The group, which was calling attention to the connection between the obstruction of health care reform legislation and large campaign contributions made by the insurance, pharmaceutical, and managed care industry, is part of a year-long campaign organized by the Alliance for Democracy. This was the sixth of the so-called Democracy Brigades, organized by the Alliance to commit nonviolent civil disobedience at the Capitol building. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nick Penniman, director of the Alliance for Democracy, who describes his group's campaign and connections he hopes to make with the growing student-based global social justice movement.
The Democracy Brigade Project is the centerpiece of our Clean Elections campaign. the purpose of which is to inject nonviolent direct action into the push for campaign finance reform. And that the nonviolent direct action is an element that we think has been missing too long in the push for clean elections, and that's why we're introducing it now.
And maybe you could review some of the actions that you have undertaken thus far in that campaign.
Sure. We began back in October of last year, October of 99, and have completed since then a wave of six acts of civil disobedience in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building that have ranged in participation from 30 to 15 or so participants. All in all, probably about 100 people have taken place in the brigades, and they're very dignified civil disobedience events where folks from all walks of life stand up and speak out in the rotunda, and because they're doing it in the rotunda, and because there's a statute that prohibits protesting in the rotunda, they're normally arrested for their actions. But we always try to, with these actions, we always try to connect them to different themes, and this week's theme was the connection between the obstruction of healthcare reform legislation and its connection to campaign cash.
What's the media reaction to your civil disobedience and making the connections you do with critical issues here in the U.S. to the lack of campaign finance reform in the system?
It's pretty mercurial, Scott. I mean, the media depends on, you know, they're so celebrity-driven, and very rarely do they care about the content, as you can imagine. I mean, the content of this week was pretty astonishing and very timely in that in the last 10 years, the healthcare industry has contributed over $250 million to congressional campaigns. And it's no wonder that, you know, the Patients' Bill of Rights, which we've been talking about intensely for 2 years now, and that 90% of the citizens believe in, is stalled in Congress at the end of a congressional session. So, you know, the fact that they're not willing to make the linkage between that $250 million and the stalling of real health care reform is, I think, symptomatic of their general lack of interest in these issues.
Civil disobedience direct action is certainly one of a range of tactics and different strategies that groups like yourselves have used to try and create a vibrant dialogue on reforming our campaign finance system. What do you think is going to actually push this over the edge? There are many in the campaign finance movement who think this may have to be passed on a state-by-state basis before it can change on a federal level. What are some of your thoughts on that?
I think it's a kind of a 1-2 punch. I think that organizations like Public Campaign have worked hard to prove that public funding is viable, and they've accomplished that, as you probably know, in Maine, Arizona, and Massachusetts. So there is a, you know, accomplishing it and showing its viability at the state level is part one of the strategy. But part two of the strategy is that we really need to turn the push for campaign finance into a true American reform movement. And that means we have to do things and use muscles that we haven't been using for a while. And those muscles are the traditional activist muscles of nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, and grassroots agitation. For too long, Scott, the issue of campaign finance reform has been a gray suit, pinstripe, beltway issue. And I have to say that, you know, as my colleagues down there in Washington have in many ways managed it right into the ground. For 30 years, we've lost on campaign finance. It's time to start winning. We think the only way to do that is to mobilize people by using nonviolent direct action.
What are some of the connections that your organization has, the Alliance for Democracy, with the growing global social justice movement we've seen develop in the United States and around the world since the major actions against the World Trade Organization in Seattle?
The corporate critical movement that was in many ways kind of came into its own in Seattle has yet to develop a legislative strategy that addresses the issue of corporate domination and conglomeration. And they've yet to develop, really, in many ways, also a domestic focus for their energy. The alliance is involved in, you know, the critique of the WTO, IMF, and World Bank, but that's not necessarily a sustainable battle to fight at the international level. We've got to come up with national concerns, and for, in our opinion, that national concern is campaign finance. It's the first domino that has to fall to break down the power that corporations now have.
That was Nick Penniman, director of the Alliance for Democracy. Contact the Alliance by calling area code 781-894-1179 or visit their website at www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. The Council on Latin American and Iberian Studies at Yale University recently hosted a community forum titled Ending the Cold War with Cuba. Gabriel Camacho, president of the Massachusetts Chapter Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, spoke about the effects of the blockade on workers in Cuba. Other topics of discussion included current U.S.-Cuba legislation and the state of democracy and human rights on the island. Since the September 23rd conference, the House voted to lift unilateral sanctions against Cuba, Libya, Iran, Sudan, and North Korea. But it is cash-strapped Cuba alone that cannot be issued U.S. government or commercial credit to buy essential food and medicine. Although legally able to purchase goods from the U.S. for the first time in four decades, Havana says the restrictions on credit and other technical issues are the main reasons it will refuse to do business under these conditions. Mary Alice Waters is the president of Pathfinder Press, which has published many books on Cuban literature and politics. She spoke at the Yale Community Forum and reflected on the history of the Cuban Revolution and why she believes it has survived despite continued U.S. aggression against the Cuban people.
It was this small handful of incorruptible revolutionaries who didn't set out to change the world. They merely wanted to get rid of the hated dictatorship that was backed by the military might of Washington, and establish a small element of social justice. And in that process, they transformed themselves and they became human beings. Fidel, who was then the prime minister of Cuba, described it well. Conflicts with Washington began in these very first months of the revolution. He went on. He says, the notes from the U.S. State Department began to rain down on Cuba. They never asked us about our problems, he said. They never expressed sympathy or because of their responsibility in creating these problems. They never asked how many died of starvation in our country, of tuberculosis, how many were unemployed. No, every conversation we had with representatives of the U.S. government centered around the telephone company, the electrical company, the problem of the land owned by U.S. companies. What would be the expected casualties of an invasion of Cuba at that moment? And they reported that they could expect, at a minimum, 18,000 casualties in the first 10 days of any attempted invasion. And that's when Kennedy and the rest began looking for some other alternative. That's more casualties than the U.S. was going to suffer in the first years of the war against Vietnam. And that's what they said would happen in the first 10 days alone of any attempted invasion of Cuba. And that is the origin of the Cold War against Cuba. It was the fiasco at the Bay of Pigs and the preparedness of the Cuban people at the time of the missile crisis that led to that negotiated settlement. The price was simply too high. From that point on, Washington set out to try to overturn the Cuban Revolution by using as its primary weapon the economic, diplomatic, and political warfare that has dominated U.S. policy for the last 40 years. I say primary because they never gave up the other things whenever the possibilities arose. Biological agents fostering counter-revolutionary bands and operations based in the U.S. and all the rest. But the origins are very important because Washington's Cold War against Cuba is not an extension of the Cold War against the Soviet Union. The fact that the brutal and the bureaucratic regime that dominated Soviet life for decades, that was a regime that was a negation of socialism, collapsed, as the Cubans like to say, like a meringue of its own internal contradictions, doesn't mean that the Cold War against Cuba is simply an anachronism. It's historically inaccurate. There are many, many good reasons to end the Cold War against Cuba, but that is not the heart of it. The Cold War against Cuba has always been about Cuba, about the Cuban Revolution, not Moscow or anything else. It's been about the strength and steadfastness of the Cuban people and the caliber of the Cuban revolutionary leadership, its revolutionary incorruptible character, and nothing else. When the Soviet bureaucracy imploded, Washington hoped Cuba would be easy pickings, that the sudden and brutal slashing of the standard of living would lead to popular discontent and a collapse of support for the revolutionary power. They failed to understand, as they always have from the very beginning, that the leadership of the Cuban Revolution is not some tropical variant of a Stalinist-type regime, but a truly popular internationalist leadership. And far from collapsing, the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban working people, have emerged stronger today, more confident, despite the enormous problems they face and difficulty. The question that is most frequently posed in meetings and discussions that I know I have been involved in is the question of how has Cuba survived, not only these 40 years, but especially this last 10 years. How has it come through, despite the fact the loss of 85% of its foreign trade virtually overnight, compounded by the intensification of the U.S. economic warfare against an underdeveloped country that it was brutally thrust into the world market after decades. There's no other government anywhere in the world that could have survived as the Cuban Revolution has survived, and as the Cuban leadership has often frequently points out. You can ask yourself, is this something they're exaggerating when they say this? I don't think so. I don't think it's bragging. I think it's the fact. And it's a registration of the depth of the popular support for a genuine socialist revolution that has brought about a deep-going transformation of social relations in Cuba, a society that's built on social solidarity, not on the dog-eat-dog social relations that we exist under and live under constantly with capitalism. A society that's built on a genuine commitment to international solidarity throughout Latin America, Africa, and the world.
That was Mary Alice Waters, president of Pathfinder Press. For more information about Pathfinder, call area code 212-388-9346. This segment was recorded by Martin Koppel and produced by your reporter, Denise Manzari. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.